Our second panelist this morning, Richard B. Allen, is a native of New Jersey. He received his bachelor's and master's degrees from Notre Dame and has worked for his PhD at the University of Munich. He is the author or co-author of Peace or Peaceful Coexistence, published about 3 months ago by the American Bar Association. Co-author of a high school textbook entitled Democracy Confronts Communism, which will appear in next spring, and co-author of East-West Trade, Its Strategic Implications. He's a contributor to Peace and War in the Modern Age, Sino-Soviet Rivalry, and Détente, Cold War Strategies in Transition. Formerly a research principal at the Center for Strategic Studies at Georgetown University, he is now at the Hoover Institution on War, Revolution, and Peace at Stanford University. Dick.
Thank you, Ed. I might mention that two of my former colleagues in different capacities here this morning are the co-authors of studies which Ed mentioned on East-West trade and strategic implications. I was privileged to serve as co-author to Colonel Samuel Claybaugh, who's in the room, and I was also a contributor to Bob Crane's book on détente Cold War strategies in transition. For those of you that haven't heard my dog bite story, I will tell you that, and it's boring to those of you who have, I'll tell you there's now been 1 year, 1 month, and 9 days since I was bitten by a rabid dog in Cabinda, Portuguese East Africa, West Africa, I beg your pardon. And they say that 1 year, 1 month, and 9 days is an adequate period of time to determine whether or not one does have rabies. So the kind of foaming in which I'll engage this morning in the brief remarks that I'll have to make could not be construed as directly rabies via the Portuguese route, but a form of intellectual rabies, which perhaps is contagious from such places as Munich, Washington, and Palo Alto, California. The kind of danger with which we're faced today is an historical danger. I think it constitutes the principal danger and will constitute the principal danger for the foreseeable future. That is, the danger emanates from the Soviet Union and from its vast body of allies throughout the world in terms of ruling communist parties and communist parties active in societies generally characterized as free societies. There exist in the world 90 communist parties. 14 of them are ruling and 76 are active elsewhere. It's important to remark at this juncture, and I'll underscore this in a few moments, that the overwhelming majority of communist parties now find themselves in the Soviet camp. That is, they specifically, categorically align themselves with the policy goals of the Soviet Union. This is interesting, and it reflects to a great extent upon the nature of our discussion here this morning. It's unfortunate that a relatively unsophisticated argument originated in an office in Washington, D.C. should turn into the major topic of attention to occupy your time here at the Philadelphia Society. However, it's a critical, I think it's a critical and far-reaching question, one which demands our most serious attention. It certainly demands the attention of people in Washington who are making the decisions. The Soviet Union, as a matter of fact, is a power-oriented society. It's a society which seeks, first of all, the augmentation of its power. And the reason for the augmentation of power is for the pursuit of vastly and genuinely sophisticated revolutionary goals around the world. I should suggest at the outset, too, that my colleague Frank Johnson makes a fundamental mistake when he presumes that the entire scope of the threat is military, for it's much more complex and I think much more fundamental than merely a military threat. The development of revolutionary theory in the Soviet Union since 1917 has been rapid and dynamic. It underwent a period of, one might say, of constipation under the rule of Stalin, and it was only with the emergence of Khrushchev on the scene that revolutionary theory began to become dynamic again And for the period of 1956, that is from the 20th Party Congress to the present day, the developments have been significant. It is not in 1956, as Frank pointed out, that Khrushchev solidified himself in power, but in 57. And the real test of that, of course, came in the ousting and final dissolution of the so-called anti-party group in June and July of 1957, when Khrushchev really was in the saddle. And it's because of Nikita Khrushchev's contribution to revolutionary theory that we have developed a certain set of reactions and attitudes to analyze our own relationships with the Soviet Union. Really, the payoff period of peaceful coexistence, which is, has now been a major strategic umbrella for Soviet doctrine and, of course, Soviet action for the past 11 years, the payoff period is beginning now. The strategy of peaceful coexistence does not imply merely economic competition, the overtaking of one society by the other, but it implies a vastly, again, complex and subtle revolutionary doctrine which is designed to bring about an ultimate goal, that is the demise, if not the absolute destruction, not necessarily physically or militarily, but the destruction of societies not now communist, and the supplanting of those communists, those societies not now communist, by a communist totalitarian regime. Crudely stated, that is the goal. It remains the goal and has not been tempered, in my judgment, by certain factors which Frank mentioned, to which I will turn very shortly. The payoff period of peaceful coexistence may be from now forward, from this point on in 1966 forward, because it's a long-term strategy. It's not designed to bring about victory in any decisive, single, earth-shaking, catastrophic revolutionary event. It is a policy of subversion. In that sense, it is insidious. It is a policy of psychological warfare and political warfare, fourth-dimensional warfare, which, incidentally, our friend Robert Crane has worked out in a very interesting formulation, calling it psycho-strategic advance. The Sino-Soviet split, of course, we all know, really broke out into the open following the Cuban Missile Crisis. And as the Sino-Soviet split really broke out into the open in the summer of 1963, our own reactions and attitudes toward the Soviet Union began to change. There were certain historic things that happened in 1962 and 63, which today are having their own form of payoff. I refer specifically to the Cuban Missile Crisis and the development of the détente, which began immediately in the weeks following the Cuban Missile Crisis. I refer to the President's June 1963 speech, the Strategy for Peace speech, John F. Kennedy's, in which he asked us to review our own attitudes toward the Soviet Union, to look upon it not with malice, but with understanding. I referred to the encyclical Pacem in Terris, which, in my judgment, happens to be one of the most catastrophic documents of modern times in terms of international politics. And I refer to the signing of the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. By 1965 and 1966, the Chinese had suffered irreversible defeats throughout the world. They suffered defeats in 1965 and 66 in Africa, beginning already in 64 in the tiny country of Burundi. They've suffered defeats in Indonesia. They've suffered them in Ghana. They may yet suffer them in Guinea, elsewhere. The Chinese strategy of violent revolution is one which has been discredited by the passage of time, particularly the passage of time of the last 2 years. It will not succeed, primarily because China is a weak nation. It will not succeed now because China has begun to border on the irrational. The rational kind of communist revolutionary theory with which we're confronted today is the brand of Khrushchev. One should not underestimate, in my judgment, the contributions which Khrushchev made to this body of revolutionary theory. They're phenomenal. Beginning with the 20th Party Congress speech, and the enunciation of peaceful coexistence as the strategic umbrella, the strategic doctrine, there have been subtle and marked shifts in Soviet revolutionary theory. I say Soviet to include the bulk of the communist parties of the world. And it is adjusted to the realistic conditions which prevail today. In 1956, for example, it was determined that Soviet revolutionary strategy no longer fitted the underdeveloped world. It became necessary to improvise and to introduce new elements into the body of revolutionary theory, one of which had to do with the so-called National Liberation Movement, a movement that had been actively studied and actively promoted since the days of Lenin. Lenin himself had written on it in many respects and called it just that. But by 1956, when the empires began to dissolve, to release the bonds between themselves and those countries which they held in Africa, Asia, and elsewhere, Soviet theory had to change too. And it did change in a meaningful way. It changed to the extent that the Soviets were able to come up with a new theoretical formulation regarding the passage of a society from one state, be it feudal or even primitive communal, to the socialist dictatorship. The invention, of course, was the state of national democracy, which provided that states no longer would have to go through the period of revolutionary upheaval characterized by the classical Marxian capitalist proletarian clash and the ultimate victory of the proletariat and the establishment of that dictatorship of the proletariat. The Soviets adjusted their theory to the backward societies and said essentially this: it's no longer necessary for you societies which have not developed capitalist practices and techniques, have not developed the forces or the relations of production characteristic of a capitalist society, it's no longer necessary for you to pass through capitalism. Now your major function must be to concentrate on socializing the means of production to the greatest extent, aligning yourself with Soviet foreign policy desires, goals, and actions, and then passage to a form of dictatorship of the proletariat, bypassing the most critical stage of Marxian theory. A revision? I don't think so. A modernization? Yes. And it is precisely in this kind of modernization and adaptation of modern revolution, of revolutionary strategy to these times, which constitutes the major contribution of Nikita Khrushchev and others. The Soviet foreign policy has not changed since the demise of Khrushchev. The position of the Soviet Union vis-a-vis China has not changed one whit. In fact, it's become exacerbated, it's worsened. The split has deepened. Brezhnev and Kosygin are receiving as much abuse as Khrushchev himself ever took from the Chinese. And there's not, if you'll excuse the expression, a snowball's chance in hell, as my good friend Frank Johnson would point out to you. There's not a chance in hell that the Chinese leadership poses, in his words, quote, a direct threat to the Soviet leadership. It finds itself ineffectual. It finds its position eroding throughout the world. It finds that the splinter parties which it was able to create in the free world are suffering tremendous defeats. In short, the Chinese revolution is a revolution of futility. It's losing the support not only of its own memberships, of its own people, of its own adherents around the world, but it's losing its own ideological fervor. The present madness in communist China does not, in my judgment, seek to reinforce the image of a responsible revolutionary power which is convinced of its possession of the laws of history and its ultimate victory. Rather, it inspires a kind of marked awe, a wonderment, a bewilderment that in any given society could be so irrational. Just to mention, of course, the decision of the Red Guards to change all traffic lights so that red would mean go, because that is a more revolutionary color. This kind of madness was never practiced, of course, by the Soviet Union, and this serves to further undermine the credibility of communist China. There are, of course, Chinese Marxist-Leninists in the world today, but it is not Mao Zedong who is the true Leninist revolutionary. In point of fact, Khrushchev is the Leninist. He was the one that was able to take the doctrine that was becoming outmoded, a Marxist-Leninist doctrine, outmoded, and was able to revise it, give it new dynamism, and apply it to the world today. Mao Zedong, stilted and jaded, conservative in that sense, and reactionary, was unwilling to change, unwilling to adapt himself to the world today, and thus he will lose. And were Lenin alive today, it is my firm conviction that he would side most heartily and in the most polemical fashion, the best Leninist polemical fashion, with Khrushchev, with Brezhnev, and Kosygin, as opposed to siding with Mao Zedong. There are two principal arguments, which are advanced for the overall theory that the major danger with the Soviet Union is now behind us. One is the constant embourgeoisification, the constant enrichment of the Soviet Union. This theory would hold that as the Soviet citizens gain a greater appreciation and a stake in the material comforts and appointments of a modern, technologically oriented society, They will gradually put pressure on the Soviet regime to moderate its revolutionary goals abroad. This is known, as in my judgment, as the refrigerator argument. In other words, the mere possession of consumer goods would serve as a deterrent to the leadership to further revolutionary activity throughout the world, at least overt revolutionary activity. The argument holds that with the passage of time, certain changes, fundamental changes, will take place in the Soviet Union, and the goals of the leadership will be gradually muted so as, over a longer period of time, to transform them into more bourgeois and typically nationalistic kinds of goals, thereby removing the basic causes of the East-West conflict. This, of course, leads to the second stage and the second theory, that convergence is a reality, that we, in fact, are moving leftward and the Soviet Union is moving, quote, rightward, unquote. That somewhere in the middle of 1980 or 90 or 95, that we in the Soviet Union will merge on the same path. We'll begin to see that there are more interests than just the preservation of mankind and the avoidance of a nuclear conflict. We begin to see that we can work together over a period of time. And as this occurs, so the theory goes, so in direct proportion will the revolutionary ardor and the revolutionary goals of the Soviet Union and its principal allies be discarded. I don't think that Vietnam is the key test of the national liberation movement or the strategy of national liberation warfare that many make it to be. Vietnam is an important one, but it will not be the all-out decisive one. For some reason or another, after the speech of Vinh Piao last year, September 3rd, 1965, our leaders looked upon it as a new Mein Kampf, and from that drew the conclusion that if the Chinese were to lose in Vietnam, all would be lost indeed, and they would have to relinquish their position in the world communist movement. Again, they do not necessarily face this challenge. The wars of national liberation, with which we're faced now, will, in my judgment, become the principal danger in the years ahead. We'll have new Vietnams in Africa or Latin America, most probably, and the kind of support that is necessary for a war of national liberation is not all-out military support. It's the basis, it receives its basis and nourishment from highly industrialized, technologically powerful societies. It is a long-term war that is fought by proxy on the part of the communists, and this, of course, typically satisfies the revolutionary tradition of modern communism. Proxy warfare can be fought at a minimum expense. No lives, very little material, certainly not much treasure in the overall picture. The maintenance of Cuba, for example, which we heard several years ago after the Cuban Missile Crisis, in this vein. Let them have it. It's costing them $1 million a day. It'll really bleed the Soviet Union white. Well, $1 million a day is cheap at the price for the maintenance of power and influence in Cuba. We now see that Cuba still remains firmly in the Soviet communist camp. Then, too, the correlation of forces, a completely new and unique concept, which Frank, I think, mistakes for purely a military operation. Again, the correlation of forces as a new theoretical innovation in the Soviet Union and in Soviet revolutionary theory is much more sophisticated and complex than that. It means essentially the aggregate of military, moral, psychological, economic, and every other kind of powers that exist in the world today, every other kind of avenue of power, blended together and directed as a unit to the extent that it can be directed against the West. So the correlation of forces has a very great, I think, relationship to the prospects for wars of national liberation. And in the Soviet Union, the increasing drive for power is going to mean that the correlation of forces, to the extent that it can be directed against anyone, will become more powerful in its direction against us. But what about the future? I'd suggest that in combination with the wars of national liberation that we're going to be faced with in the future, that the more subtle forms of strategy are going to be used. For example, the construction of a maritime threat by the Soviet Union today, when every, I think, competent and literate observer of international affairs would now acknowledge that the Soviet maritime challenge will be great indeed in a few years. That perhaps by 1980, the Soviet Union will have a maritime fleet, commercially speaking, that will be able to outstrip us in performance, will be able to undercut us in rates, and will do great damage to our own leading position on the seas today. I don't claim any expertise in this field, incidentally. Secondly, the question of the National Liberation Movement is vitally bound up with the question of East-West trade. Now, if the assumption of Frank Johnson is correct, that we are over the hump, and that we could really work toward some kind of understanding with the Soviet Union as long as we keep our eyes open. If that assumption is correct, then we ought to go ahead and lock it up by means of specific agreements with the Soviet Union. We are, of course, beginning to trade with the Soviet Union. There are those among us that is friendly with us, generally construed as conservatives, who believe that free trade can cure everything, that we should indeed simply engage the Soviet Union in all-out trade without restriction and give them whatever they want. But as we steadily expand our trade with the East, meaning Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, we too then, I think, over the long run, tend to erode our own position in those areas of the world in which we are not firmly established and entrenched. Because as the National Liberation Movement spreads, and as attempts to perpetrate wars of national liberation certainly will spread elsewhere in the world, the support of the Soviet Union will be critical, the support of Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. To the extent that Eastern Europe and the communist bloc generally that sides with the Soviet Union is able to support those wars of national liberation, to that extent do we cut our own throat. It would probably be silly to make a comparison between scrap iron in Japan and East-West trade today. I don't think, however, that the parallels are completely invalid. The Soviet Union in the future is going to concentrate on the augmentation of its power, and the augmentation of its influence, and the increasing moral superiority of its system. It's having results to some certain extent. Those are the results that I think are the payoff period of peaceful coexistence on a worldwide scale. The Soviet Union, in my judgment, does not now believe that it can overtake the United States strategically. The Soviet Union, of course, does not want war. Wants to achieve its kind of victory by the most practicable means, which means without a nuclear war. I'm not entirely convinced that in a given situation, in the corner, the leadership would not push the button, because in desperation and influenced by a Marxist-Leninist outlook still, and not by a material outlook solely, it may indeed engage us or embroil us in nuclear war. That's a pretty far-out proposition. With respect to Eastern Europe today, upon which we concentrate so much attention, we must remember that Eastern Europe, despite increasing appearances of individualism, liberation, and nationalism, is basically in the communist camp and will so remain for a long period of time. Of course, we should try to wean Eastern Europe away. It might take 20 or 25 years, and of course, we have to be patient. Nonetheless, formidable threats can be presented to us within that period of 20 to 25 years. Now, Frank concluded by quoting the leading astrologer in Washington, D.C. That makes all the more appropriate my intention to draw on a man under whom I studied in Munich, and a name that is familiar to many of you here. I'm speaking of Erich Fogelmann, who wrote in 1951 an interesting book called The New Science of Politics. I think his description, with avoiding the nastiness of Erich Fogelmann, because he is indeed a nasty man when he's treating the Gnostics. Remember, the eschaton must not be immanentized. It's important, I think, to follow his argument here, because it's a valid one. He said in The New Science of Politics, "The identification of dream and reality as a matter of principle has practical results which may appear strange, but can hardly be considered surprising. The critical exploration of cause and effect in history is prohibited, and consequently, the rational coordination of means and ends in politics is impossible. Gnostic societies and their leaders will recognize dangers to their existence when they develop, but such dangers will be met by appropriate actions in the world of, will not be met by appropriate actions in the world of reality. They will rather be met by magic operations in the dream world, such as disapproval, moral condemnation, declarations of intentions, resolutions, appeals to the opinion of mankind, branding of enemies as aggressors, outlawing of war, propaganda for peace and for world government, etc. The intellectual and moral corruption which expresses itself in the aggregate of such magic operations may pervade a society with the weird, ghostly atmosphere of a lunatic asylum, as we experience it in our time in the Western crisis." Fogelmann goes on to say this: "There will be a latent communist danger under the most favorable external circumstances
as long as the public debate in Western societies is dominated by the Gnostic cliches. And that was reinforced this morning on a news report that I heard on the way in this morning, that Brezhnev this morning said simply, President Johnson has a strange and persistent illusion that we can settle our differences. I think that Frank's is a strange and persistent illusion, and that he ought to trade the dream world for the real one. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dick.